Part 13, Chapter 3. Dunaldin was a very happy man. The Cornwall compound of the British Isles was dead ahead, lit up like the one-time cities must have been. They had drawn straws for Cornwall. This was the mine site that sent out hunting parties and made it death for Scots to go south. The cyclos at this place, over the centuries, had gunned down people beyond count, just for sport on their days off. There was even a tale of a raiding party captured and tied to trees and shot tiny bit by tiny bit and man by man for 18 agonizing days. And many tales like it. He and his co-pilot Dwight had drawn the long straw to the envy of their fellow pilots. They had drilled the navigation. No Scot had ever gotten within 100 miles of this mine site in over 1,000 years, and little was actually known of it. But they had absorbed what there was. They had lain all night, quite relaxed, warmly dressed for stratosphere flying. They had heard the warning horns go for the final firing of the semi-annual. They had piled into their seats, hands waiting at the consoles. Wide-eyed and thrilled, they had watched Johnny's incredible sprint. Something had gone wrong as he reached the cage, and that part wasn't so good. No rescue. But Johnny had piled down under the edge of the bluff, safe as a wee bairn in his truckle bed, before the blast rifles went. The recoil had been a bit disconcerting, for it had slewed the plane out of position with concussion. But all was well. They had vaulted their plane into the sky on schedule. They had seen the planet-wide radio towers collapse in a tangle of cables behind them, hit by both the concussion of recoil and bazooka fire. A 12-hour radio silence had begun successfully. Ample time for the farthest mine site to be reached without any warning. At 2,000 miles an hour, 100,000 feet up, they had shifted the clock and come down to normal cyclo approach levels to a nighttime mine site. There it was. Scanners and view screens alight. They found no sign of hostile action, no guard planes in the air. Lighted steam was coming out of some shafts in the hills that must be 5 miles deep. Smelter chimneys belched curling green smoke. Warehouses stood in bold outline. And there were the glowing domes of the compound. Target 1. But Dunaldin, being Dunaldin, was quick to take advantage of sudden opportunities even when they were not quite specified in planning. The silly apes down there lit up the whole landing area for him. It gleamed like a bloody stage. They thought he was simply some non-scheduled cyclo flight. Bless radio silence. And Dunaldin saw something else. Strung on massive power poles, coming down from the north, was their power supply. And right there, in the full glare of the landing area, was the obvious master pole. The freaks cared nothing about an aerial navigation menace. It was the master pole. The lines from the north came down into it. The local light cables all routed out from it to the buildings and compound. There was a big open space for landing and takeoff in the middle of this spider's web. Right at the side of the landing stage was a huge wheel. Dunaldin recognized it. The master wheel that, when spun, withdrew the master bus bar from the circuit. By Dunaldin's opportunist mentality, it was simply too good to miss. Why let them have lots of light while they rushed about manning their defense weapons and trying to get out to their planes? Why not simply throw the whole thing into total chaos? And then go up and, with infrared screens, shoot the place to bits. Their own plane had a wave neutralizer copied from one stolen from a ground car, and they could turn it on and those apes wouldn't know what to shoot at. Further, if this battle plane took off, it would seem like it was a defense plane. Dunaldin spoke rapidly to a startled but agreeable Dwight. Just as casually as though they were a visiting plane, they landed right beside the big wheel, Dunedain hitched the assault rifle strap over his shoulder, opened the door of the plane, stepped down, walked over to the bus bar wheel, and gave it its first spin. It all went okay, just up to that point. But now, a cyclo in a little guardhouse they had not spotted, only 10 feet from that bus bar, stepped out and stared at Dunedain.
A toll naps!
Screamed the guard. Before Dunedain could get the assault rifle into position, the guard had closed the door and hit a siren. A bullhorn opened up enough to blast one's eardrums in.
Toll-nap attack! All posts! Toll-naps! Guard positions!
Regardless of what toll-naps might be, Dunedain spun the bus bar wheel so fast it screamed. He realized then why it was so close to the landing stage. They darkened the place for attack precautions, and had a guardhouse right handy to do it. Dunedain raced back to the plane. He dove in. Dwight's assault rifle opened up as guards boiled out of a stairwell. They dissolved into luminous green flashes. The battle plane soared. Dunedain threw on the wave neutralizer and infrared screens. They reverted to plan. With guns set to no flame, maximum concussion, they roared across the compound. The domes squashed like punctured balloons. They raced across the lines of warehouses and knocked their roofs flat. For good measure, they made another pass, this time dropping non-radiation anti-personnel bombs. One gun opened up at them, and the plane took a jolt. They flashed down and squashed the gun with a single blast. And that was the end of the base. The Cyclo Intergalactic Mining Company did not believe in lavishing money on safety equipment in any department, apparently. And hadn't Johnny said something about Turl calling in all the armaments from these bases? From what they could gather, standing by way up in the air, the creatures in the compound had been unable to get the masks on before the domes were smashed, for there certainly wasn't any mob coming out. They hung around for a while, occasionally knocking out an isolated vehicle and a stray guard. It really was quiet down there after that. Then they saw something on their radar screen. It was an incoming transport. Abruptly, they recalled transport plane engines leaving after the incoming firing. This thing had been slow-poking its way home, and they had passed it. Good. Dunedain, much to Dwight's dismay, landed beside the bus bar and turned it on. They just sat there. The landing lights were now on. Any Cyclo employee left alive was not concentrating on coming out. The transport plane landed. The Cyclos got out, fooled around with baggage. Then the pilot got out. The Cyclos walked in a mob toward the compound. Then they began to feel something was wrong and stopped. The Cyclo pilot reached for his belt gun. Dunedain and Dwight cut them down with assault rifles. Dunedain flew Dwight over to the fuel dump. They knew what fuel cartridge the transport took, for it was a duplicate of the plane that had brought Johnny to Scotland. Dwight got the fuel cartridges. Dunedain brought him back to the transport plane. Dwight took the old cartridges out and put new ones in. Dunedain shot a guard car that had survived and came racing toward them. It blew up. Dunedain got into the air. Dwight flew the transport up. Dunedain shot the master power pole to bits in a fanfare of sparks and flashes. Seeing that Dwight was well clear, Dunedain flew to a point about 10 feet above the breathe gas dump. He dropped a low-yield, lead-shielded, time-fused, radioactive mine on it. He soared up, and the dump roared in a lovely green-blue flash. He again checked to see where Dwight had gotten to, saw he was safe. Dunedain soared to 10,000 feet, nosed the plane over, sighted, and fired at the explosives dump. It went up like a miniature volcano. Absolutely beautiful. He dropped back and verified that the compound had not exploded. This was part of their orders. The machinery and stored planes were apparently intact. With no atmosphere to breathe and no fuel to fly, with 90% of its personnel probably dead, the mine site in Cornwall was a write-off. That paid for a lot of crimes. Donaldine fell in beside the transport.
"What's a toll-nip?"
asked Donaldine. Dwight didn't know either, but Donaldine supposed he did look strange in a Chinko air mask and U.S. Air Force stratosphere flying gear. They had already agreed on a new and wonderful plan Donaldine had thought up. They had almost 6 hours of radio silence left, orders complete, and time on their hands. Donaldine was related to the chief of Clan Fergus, and besides, there was a lass he had not seen for nearly a year. They hoped the other 14 mine-site attack planes had done as well. Of course, perhaps not with the same style. They headed for Scotland.